Hello and welcome to E3, Energy and Efficiency with Emily. This year on the podcast, we're going to try some new things and see what sticks. For those who have been around for a while, I'm going to keep the podcast short and sweet. Your time is valuable. For those new to the podcast, I'm Emily Mottram. I'm your host, and we're going to talk about building science, architecture, and female entrepreneurship. So prepare to get nerdy. Six years of podcasts, some good, some a little crazy, and starting off with a bang this year, talking to my friend Steve Demetric, a contractor down in Rhode Island. In fact, it was so good, I split this into two episodes, so enjoy.
I think maybe in some ways, architects and designers have gotten used to just designing what we want and not necessarily thinking about what you guys have to do with it to make it happen on the site.
That's what I've been battling for my entire career.
Yeah, I know, right? I mean, it's just...
It's not just architects. It's anybody that is doing things that affect the people that actually have to do the work. That includes manufacturers, includes homeowners. Person doing the work is at the project. And even like tool manufacturers. It's like I always say all the best engineers went into bridge building, you know? I think the ones that went into tool manufacturing, I think they all left like in 1950, and then we've just been, you know, tweaking them with different colors or something.
It's funny that you say that because I just taught a course with Nikki out in Denver. She was talking about somebody decided to make a tool that was actually fit for women's hands.
5 or 6 years ago, I had to research a new miter saw. Like, I don't even use miter saws anymore because I'm running a construction company. But I remember my brother and one of my other crew members, Josh, and I went to a couple of different power tool stores, and one of them had like an open house day with all the manufacturers, and every single machine had one or two features we really liked, but then none of the machines would have those features. So it's beyond me why nobody's gone and found out all the features that everybody likes and just make one saw with those features. And they're all the subtle things that the only people that know that have that information are the people that use them every day.
That's part of the reason why I wanted to, you know, have you on and do some more recording and talk more about this, you know, both for me working forward on some of my projects, but also for everybody else. You talked a little bit about it, but I'd love for you to kind of expand more on where you think the most time and material savings too, right? So following along with the size of materials that we get, right, that are made, also cuts down on the amount of waste that you create, which is a cost saving.
Oh, huge. Yeah, like the house that we're finishing right now, it's what, 1800 square feet with a probably like a 14 by 16 foot screened in porch, and I think we've used 5 dumpsters, like just little 6 yard dumpsters. Mm-hmm. I forget, it's either a six or a four for the entire project.
And the things that are in that dumpster are mostly offcuts or the packaging?
The majority of it is packaging.
Yeah.
Yeah, the majority of it's packaging. We recycle all the cardboard. Well, everything we can. You know, there's packaging. Everyone's there working. There's lunch waste in there.
Sure.
But yeah, I'd say mostly packaging. But framing-wise, like we actually, that first dumpster made it all the way through the exterior shell. We design around the sizes of the materials that we can order. And it also helps to know what sizes your materials come in. Like I just learned today, like we have a house, which I'm not excited about the material, but we're wrapping it in AZEK board and batten. And I met with one of the manufacturer's reps today, and I didn't, like we always knew they come in 8 foot sheets and 10 foot sheets, but I didn't know that they will sell it to you up to 20 feet long. And anything in between. It doesn't cost anymore because you're just buying it by the square foot. Say you get a dormer and they're all 6 footers. Well, I can order 12 foot sheets and cut them in half and have no waste. That's really interesting to me versus having a big pile of plastic cutoffs.
So how much time do you think that it takes you to plan for things like that?
Well, if you have the information, it's not a lot of time. I'd say it's not a lot of time because, you know, if you already have the information, like if you're trying to, it's not something where you go take a class and you learn how to do this calculation, you know. It's like, oh, I just learned how to do like a woofy model. It's like, oh, you learned how to use the tool. But no, it's more about if you make that a priority in the work that you do, you're going to pay attention to that stuff. And I find like when you're learning on the on the job, the stuff that sticks with you is stuff that's important to you. Like stuff that you're interested in and stuff that's important to you, you'll pay attention to that and you'll recall that. It'll become part of your toolbox of mental notes. And that's something that's always been important to me. And so I've always paid attention to it. And so for me, it's not like I design with that in mind. It's analogous to like when you get into high performance design, those details that we put into our buildings, like the layouts of plumbing, overhangs, where's our glazing, how are we going to organize our spaces for people to enjoy natural light, but then also not overheat the room. Like we're, they think it's natural for an architect to think about designing for light and flow, but are they designing for overheating from Western glazing? Not all of them.
But they should be.
They should be, yeah. Yeah, that's some of those values that go, those concepts are, if you value them, become part of your approach and you just do it. So for example, like that AZEC siding job, someone has to sit down with the plan elevations and you know you're getting sheets that are 4 feet wide. That layout needs to be put on the plans. And we're going to take a full-size set of plans and we're going to take a red pencil and just draw out where every piece is going to be and label it and then create a key. And then when my guys get the order in the field, they'll have that plan set and the list, which is no different than if you're planning a framing job. Someone's going to go through and put together the first order is the sills, the floor system, and the plywood, and they're going to figure out how much material they need.
The builder is the one who ends up with the largest amount of risk. So you're going to go back through and you're going to review all of that stuff. You're not just going to take my drawing and be like, she says I need 48 sheets of plywood. And like, yeah, that's probably correct.
I mean, a good builder is going to want to do their own material takeoffs, because in the process of doing those material takeoffs, they're organizing and building the house in their head. And that kind of gets their head into the job. So in that sense, the builder would want, I mean, a good builder, I think, would want to do their own takeoffs. And it also helps because there's going to be stuff that you might miss. They might build things a certain way. You know, there's just subtleties to that. And there's reasons why. I think one of the things that people forget when they think about their builder or their contractor is that they're not a robot who's just doing what they're told to do. The ones that, like at my crew, like we're all real craftspeople. Like they're all craftsmen and they're not into the work for the money. It's fortunate that they have a craft that they really enjoy doing and they can actually get paid to do it. But they're craftspeople first. I mean, the money is really close to it because everybody needs money to live. But they do that job because they really, really enjoy it. They're not pushing paper. They're not punching buttons. It's not just about a job, check in, check out. It's part of your soul. A lot of these synthetic products rip the heart and soul out of the craftsperson because they have to be installed without any craft. Like they have to be installed with big gaps and big blobs of caulk. You know, they have to be installed in such a way that you can't hide your joinery. All the thought and care and knowledge that you go into becoming an excellent craftsperson, which is based in, I'm talking about, when I say craftsperson, I think of like the traditional New England carpenter, builder, architect, like going all the way back to like Asher Benjamin. And you look at all the books and layouts and the reasons why those designs in his books from 1807 look like that. And everything from then since is there's reason and thought that goes into there that became a tradition. And that's how I learned. I learned from people that learned from people that learned from people. And like, actually, it's fascinating. Like one of the people that I worked side by side with in Wickford, Rhode Island, his grandfather worked with someone who learned furniture making from John Townsend, you know, Goddard Townsend, furniture makers in Newport, Rhode Island in the 1700s. Literally, like, you know, like there's like seven people of separation. Like I'm like five to John Townsend. Direct lineage from like this guy learned from his dad, who learned from his grandfather, whose grandfather worked with that guy. Like that's New England. That's where crafts, like that's kind of an absurd example because I really have no relation to them at all. But that New England craft tradition, that's where it comes from. And when I say craftsperson, that's who I'm talking about. And yeah, and those people care about the work they do, and that care starts with the plans and being able to build it the way it is meaningful to them. And if you just switch out a product like that they're not just some rote person that's going to be like, oh yeah, I'm going to nail up this cement board instead of the clapboard.
Swapping a material for another material is not apples to apples, both in the craftsmanship level and especially in the high performance world.
Oh gosh, no. Yeah, everything, it's a system. Everything's a system. And the people are part of that system.
You know, the best structures just wouldn't have occupants. That would be great.
I agree with that, but I also feel like if you're going to be an idiot, you should deserve the consequences. I like resiliency and I like some fluctuations in human beings. But yeah, if somebody wants to start drying their cordwood in the basement, just go for it.
In some ways, it's like, well, maybe it's risky today, but maybe next year it won't be risky. Or maybe it's not even really risky today because honestly, last year we had, what, one day when it was really, really cold? And we're designing to that based on past history, but can we look at past history? Because are we ever going backwards far enough to say, you know, over the next 5 years, we'll really have that again?
You know, I think they expect, like when you talk about the comfort thing, I think we're designing for an expectation that is way too high. I think that's part, and there's a lot of cost that comes with that. You know, it's like, just put a sweater on, you know. Like if we changed our design set points from, like, what, I don't know, I'm not even sure what they are, but like, if you think of the average thermostat and Rhode Island is set at 70 or 72 in the winter. Like if we put it at 65 and then designed for that, we wouldn't need double stud walls or exterior insulation. You could make it airtight, some triple glazed windows and some mineral wool bats, and you'd be good to go. Come, like, go back to carpet.
No, I don't agree with carpet.
But I mean, but as far as just basic comfort, like, you'll be fine.
We took out all of our carpet because, you know, in my smart youth, shall we say, I used to do a lot of energy audits and spend a lot of time in people's attics and their basements without any kind of PPE, right? Like, I've climbed in so much dusty cellulose.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Oh,
you know, and so I think that I have pushed myself to the point where now dust is a bigger issue for me than maybe it would have, right? Just exposure to all this stuff. I can't imagine what your carpets hold on to, like how much the carpet...
Oh, carpets are great.
When you rip it out, like, oh, I wonder if people have allergens. Yes, as far as a comfort level, I do think that people were attracted to having carpet. As far as an indoor quality issue, I'm not sure carpet is the best solution for most people.
Oh, there's actually some really good carpets out there that are like just thinner nap, all natural materials. And
well, and that's the other thing is, you know, that 90% of carpet is the stuff that you don't want to put in.
Oh yeah, but carpet's a terrible example. I was just thinking of warm feet. I should have said slippers instead.
Well, and you say that, warm feet, slippers, 65 degrees. I grew up in a house that was built in the 1700s, and my dad would always say, like, put on another sweater. And so I appreciate that you talk about the comfort level because we've gotten to the point where people are only comfortable between 5 and 8 degrees.
Well, the reasons we're doing this stuff is for energy. Honestly, if occupant behavior we know is a major part of it. Like, you could build a certified net zero passive house and then put three Hummers in the garage at 8 miles per gallon and TVs in every room that are not the nice LED ones, and then throw two pottery kilns in the basement. Yeah, heated outdoor pool in northern Maine. Yeah, your energy loads just went through the roof. So yeah, those are all wild examples, but like...
Even without the Hummers, right? Most of these are built somewhere that you have to drive. And most people have more than one car.
That's actually only a particular one, because when we had our fourth kid and we had to go... No, third kid, we had to go to minivan. The Hummer actually had better gas mileage than the Toyota Sienna minivan. And I tried to convince my wife to get one just to prove the point. She's like, no way. I mean, it fit the same eight passengers, so it was great. But
yeah,
she didn't want to be caught dead driving around town in a Hummer. It wasn't that much more either. I thought it would have been hilarious, but yeah, I wasn't the one driving it. If this was a stay-at-home dad, he would have had a Hummer.
But we do drive everywhere. We're car dependent, you know, so we're trying to make these better improvements with our built environment. I liked the project that you sent that we included in the Pretty Good House book was actually an in-town lot. Do you do a lot more, you know, in-town lots? Is that common for you?
No, it's so hard to find anything. Yeah, land in southern Rhode Island, yeah, land is really, really tough to find. Yeah, it's basically, you're looking, that's why, I mean, long-term, I think, I'm long-term, I mean, short-term, we got to be looking at remodeling. And also that's kind of why I said that, made that comment about just shifting our expectations a little bit would make a difference. But I think like my brother, who's worked with me for almost 20 years, he lives in downtown Wakefield. He lives in a house that was built in like 1870. It's probably 1800 square feet, balloon framed. It's hot water radiators with an oil-fired boiler in the basement and a really nice wood stove with a blower on it. And he changed out to a heat pump hot water heater when his water heater went. So he's got that in the basement. And he's able to turn the boiler off for like half the year. But he keeps his thermostat at like 62, I think. And only when you get those times when it goes down to like low teens or something, then he turns it up a little bit higher. And then Rhode Island Energy, they send out like once a month or every other month, they send out a letter to everybody about how you compare to your neighbors. And he's like a blip compared to everybody else. And that's all it is. It's just how you use your space.
How you use your space, especially when you have an existing space. When to renovate. People also really would love to have zero maintenance houses, which we all know don't exist.
That's such a myth.
It's just not a thing.
Yeah, that's like saying, I want to eat cereal, but I don't want to have milk. It's like, well, no, you can't have it both ways.
Our house was painted what was probably a lovely shade of red at one time. That faded to a nice shade of pink, and it was built in the 70s, so it probably allowed the moisture to escape from the interior of the house and peeled the paint. So they covered it with vinyl siding. You know, the wood siding might be in decent condition, and if it is, when we take it off, we'll scrape it, we'll do what we can from the interior to keep it from bleeding paint off of it, and we'll keep it. If it's not in great shape, when we take it off, we'll put in an air barrier on the exterior over whatever is on it, and that will be the time when we'll improve.
Yeah, and then maybe you do the new windows at that time, or maybe you remove the windows and reinstall the same windows. We've done that before.
Our house faces east, and all of the east windows have been replaced. They face the water. I'm sure that over time, they just were struggling harder. The south and west windows are still the wood windows. Honestly, they still open. The paint probably needs to be scraped, but they're fine.
That guy talked a lot about like materials and sizing and stuff like that. But I think a big part of it too is the care in which stuff is put together, which again, it comes back to craftsmanship. You know, having like the knowledge that we have now that a really good craftsman has includes knowledge of rain screens and like expansion and contraction of materials, like things that we need to worry about now that you didn't have to think about in the 70s or earlier. But yeah, how those assemblies go together is also part of the craft and part of that conversation about craftsmanship is a huge part of sustainability. Sustainability seems to be all about the materials.
We're talking about efficiency. We're talking about all this stuff. We're talking about these experimental products. Which ones are we going to be pulling out in, you know, 20 to 40 years that were like, this seemed like a great idea at the time. I mean, like asbestos, it was great. It was a great material. Turns out it's not great for you.
Well, so was naphtha at one point when every cleaning product that was used in the house was laced with naphtha because it was amazing.
I mean, lead paint, it was great. You know, even oil-based paints stuck to everything. Turns out they're not so great for you as well.
I really don't think it's the fault of the product. It's the fault of the installation and the fault of the lack of knowledge of the designer or installer and how it integrates with everything else in the building.
There are probably a couple of bad products.
It's bad installation. There's also like building codes that allow you to be at 3 air changes per hour and not have a ventilation system. In a larger house, that can be a huge problem. It comes down to how things go together.
So when you're talking about materials and the sizes that they come in, a lot of materials come in 8-foot sections.
Yep. And we actually use zip sheathing, comes in 9 and 10 foot length. And so we install it vertically. You don't need any of the horizontal blocking. Saves a lot of labor. And so for example, like when we do our in-house designs, and then when I work with an architect that allows me to integrate our knowledge into their design before they get too far, we'll actually design for, let's say we wanted 9 foot ceiling, maybe instead of 9 feet, maybe they end up at, I don't know, like 8 foot, 9.5 or something. And what we do is we take the bottom of the bottom plate to the top of the top plate, and we make that the height of the sheet. So then when you take it off the pile, you don't have to cut anything.
Is it easier to cut a piece of sheetrock?
They're cutting everything anyways. Yeah, and there's also subtleties too. Like we have this problem come up that we're now, it costs a little bit more money to fix it, but if you have an 8-foot ceiling and you're using sheetrock, the bottom 3 inches has the bevel in it. So when you go to put your baseboard up, it goes at an angle. Unless somebody goes and puts a piece of tape in there and then just basically flat tapes that whole area.
So you want them to cut it off anyway?
Well, we end up flat taping it. But like, those are the things that people are like, oh, I don't want to cut all that sheetrock. Well, the sheetrocker's cutting around everything everywhere.
Yeah. So those are kind of the judgment calls that you have to talk to your builder about to find out. Because if you told me, oh no, like the sheetrocker is going to complain if they have to do whatever, then you would work the opposite direction, right? You'd say, okay, based on the inside, this material comes in this shape, you know?
Whenever we do stuff that's like different or outside of the normal, and normal means what we did in 1980s. Because most of the people in the field, they're doing it the way their dad did it or their grandfather or whoever else they learned from, who learned from the person before them. And so if we go outside of that traditional norm, I always talk to them first. I don't just throw it at them and say, here, do this. I get their feedback first. I also have enough experience that I can generally anticipate what they're going to say. And if I'm wrong, it's never catastrophic. They're just like, hey, I got to charge you a little more because this was a pain in the neck. And I'm like, sure. I threw you a curveball, so, and you're able to hit it, so you deserve extra for being able to hit the hard pitch.
So if you had to prioritize, where you started with it, what trade or what thing would you kind of start with?
I start with a carpenter. They are the jack of all trades. They're the ones that get affected
yeah.
The most. Is the carpenter.
We try to make our foundations to whole numbers as much as we can.
Oh, you don't have like 21 feet, 3.5 inches?
Yeah.
Like 61 feet, 5/8?
Yeah.
Those are numbers from a real plan set.
3 and 156.
Oh, there you go. Why not?
So, concrete-free slabs, yes or no?
Oh, it depends.
That's my answer to everything.
You have to look at the project and the goals of the project. Like, actually, I was just talking with Jesse Thompson from Kaplan Thompson. They're doing a project on some island off the coast, and they really want to try to do a concrete-free slab just because they had to bring everything over on a boat at certain tide because there isn't even a dock or a ramp for the boat. So like, that's definitely in that case.
Yeah.
All of our houses are smaller. Like, we're trying to keep all of our buildings below like 2,400 square feet. And in that size, there's really no reason to not to do a concrete-free slab. There are a few reasons why maybe you should do concrete. Because one would be like water table. Like, if you've got a really big water table issue, like we did a house that water was in a normal situation was about 20 inches below the bottom of the slab. And so we had to switch to mineral wool insulation. Like, I wasn't going to put EPS down there because if we did have an instance where the water table rose up, then that whole basement's going to iceberg. So we put in, we put in mineral wool. And once you go to mineral wool, and that's like, well, now you can't use plywood. So like that'd be a good example. Yeah, like I have a project that we're still in design on. There's an architect working on it, and they were debating whether to go between doing like a pier foundation. The building wants to feel like it's floating in the field. Do we do like grade beams and piers, and then just build it on top of that, or do we bring the foundation in a couple of feet and kind of hide it with the grade? We almost went with the piers, but then I was like, who's gonna crawl under there? I mean, it's an 1800 square foot single level building. That's 56 sheets of plywood, 4x8. Who's gonna want to be down there like with 18 inches and 56 sheets of plywood to install and tape? Why would you want to have anybody do that? Like, it's just not, that's cruel and unusual.
So what happens if you do have an issue and you have to get under there in the future too? Like, it's not like you have a lot of space to work. Like, it's hard the first time around.
Part of that resiliency is how are we building things so they can be maintained? Which, again, that's the other part of when we're planning our projects, we're also thinking of that.
I hope you'll join Steve and I next month as we continue to talk about resiliency, things that he's tried and that have worked in other areas of building, building science, and architecture. Thanks for joining in. Until next time, stay nerdy.